From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, film critic Neil Gabler on the irony of Hollywood's fantasies about America. Gabler's new book, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, explains how the early movie moguls painted a picture of this country that excluded their own experiences of poverty, anti-Semitism, and immigration. Also, Dutch-born conductor Ado de Waart discusses the joys and frustrations of conducting American orchestras. De Waart conducts the Minnesota Orchestra and is the former conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. Rock historian Ed Ward reviews the career of Chicago-born guitarist Michael Bloomfield, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bird, the new movie based on the life of Charlie Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The movie moguls who built the major studios, MGM, Columbia, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Fox, and Universal, had something in common beyond movies that were all Eastern European Jews. Film critic Neil Gabler has written a collective biography of these immigrants who built the film industry. Gabler is the former co-host of the PBS movie review show Sneak Previews. His new book opens with a paradox. The movies that created our images of America were actually made by Jewish immigrants who didn't fit into the dreams that they themselves created.
Well, the interesting thing, I think, about the individuals who created the motion picture industry, that first generation of so-called moguls, Adolf Zukor and Harry Cohn and Louis B. Mayer and the Warner Brothers and Carl Emley, was that though they are almost always characterized in history and indeed exist in our imaginations as vulgarians with gold pinky rings and a men of absolute, of no education, no culture, quite the contrary, in fact, was true in terms of their aspirations. Oddly enough, though, as I say, we characterize them as vulgarians, and though they are often regarded as the villains in the history of the movies, and by some the villains of history of in the history of American culture generally, these were men who desperately wanted, by and large, to enter those hallowed precincts of genteel American aristocracy. Most of them came to the United States and settled in the East, and they had their eyes cocked toward the Eastern aristocracy. But they were proscribed from entering those precincts because they were Jewish, because they were uneducated, because they didn't have the style that the genteel and Gentile aristocracy required.
Your book kind of asks the question, why is it that the Jews who ran the film industry made movies in which there were no Jews? When did you start wondering about that question?
Well, that question came later, I think. The initial question was, I mean, here is a fact, that the motion picture industry was created by and operated by a remarkably homogeneous group of individuals, these Eastern European Jews, whose names we discussed. And yet, that fact exists almost nowhere in American film history. I use the term in the book or the phrase that they were the phantoms of film history. They could haunt it, but they couldn't operate within it. And that issue came first for me. The issue of, here are these individuals, all of whom were Eastern European Jews. What effect did that have on them psychologically? In what way did that component move them into the movie industry? And the other issues, the issue of, you know, Jewish presence in the motion pictures and whatever, came after that initial issue.
You said that this is a subject that hadn't really come up in the history of movies. Why do you think it's a subject that went unaddressed for so long?
Partly because it's a very, very sensitive subject, Terry. Even I encountered this when I was researching the book. I encountered individuals, obviously most of the people I interviewed for the book were Jewish, many of them family members of the individuals about whom I was writing. And when I discussed the book, I heard frequently, do you really want to write a book like this? Is a book like this necessary? Some people simply wouldn't talk to me because they felt I would be opening a can of worms and creating fodder for anti-Semites. So I think partly there was that element that this is a subject that can only be used in a negative way, only be used by anti-Semites, so why raise it? And I think, quite frankly, there's another side to this, that people didn't regard it as important, that people didn't regard the moguls necessarily as important. The history of film is essentially, the way it's been written up to this point, is essentially the history of the directors and the writers and the stars. It's not the history of the executives who ran the studios and, in my opinion, set the agenda. This isn't to say that the role of the director, the star, the writer, whatever, is a negligible one. It was a very important one. But it is to say that the executives had an equally, if not more, significant role. MGM is MGM because of Louis B. Mayer, not necessarily because of the stars and directors who worked there. The stars and directors worked there because Louis B. Mayer hired them.
Okay, you mentioned Louis B. Mayer. Give us just a thumbnail sketch of his Eastern European background and how he came to America.
Well, Louis B. Mayer, though he was very loath to discuss his origins, was born in Russia, came to the United States, actually came to Canada first, and settled in St. John with his father, who was a junk man. And he moved from St. John to Boston, where he really was rather shiftless individual, had a very difficult time finding a position for himself. And almost by accident, because he'd been doing errands at a local theater, he got wind of an available theater in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And Mayer went there, rented the theater, and used that theater in Haverhill as a means of rehabilitating himself, really. He became the entrepreneur of Haverhill, Massachusetts. And from there, he moved into theatrical production and ultimately into film production.
That's a route that several of the moguls took, going from exhibition to distribution to production. Why was that such a common route?
Several reasons, Terry. I mean, one is that it required very little capital. You could set up a theater for a very small amount of money. In the case of Louis B. Mayer, I think the rental of the theater and the equipment was something like $600. Adolf Zukor, I think, spent something like $400 in outfitting his theater. So there were very few economic barriers to enter exhibition. But another reason was that I think this group of Jews had a particular sensitivity to the public, a sensitivity that they could indulge and exercise an exhibition. Many of these individuals came from other professions prior to moving into the motion picture industry. For example, Adolf Zukor was a furrier, and he had a sensitivity to taste of necessity.
Zukor is the founder of Paramount.
That's right. Well, not really the founder of Paramount Pictures. A man by the name of Hodkinson actually founded Paramount Pictures, but it was very shortly after Hodkinson founded it that Adolf Zukor took over the company, and Adolf Zukor was responsible for making Paramount Pictures into the major film entity that it ultimately became.
My guest is Neil Gabler, the film critic who is the author of the new book, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. And it's basically the story of the film moguls who started the Hollywood movie industry. You point out that some of these Eastern European Jews who started the film industry in America were able to get a foothold in the movie business because movies were viewed suspiciously by the economic establishment, by the financial establishment. Movies were seen to be something that could undermine moral values. Describe what the climate was like and why movies were seen suspiciously.
It's not only by the financial establishment, but equally by the social and moral establishments. The motion pictures, movies very early in this century, were regarded first as a novelty, as something that would last for a very short time, that no one of any real serious interest would get involved in, that should be left to individuals like Jews and Irishmen and whatever, because this was a fly-by-night business. But very shortly after the introduction of movies, in fact, by 1905, 1906, 1907, when the Nickelodeon sprung up, which was essentially storefront theaters with, outfitted with chairs, the custodians of the moral order, the prevailing social order, realized that the movies were having a tremendous influence on individuals in this country, particularly working class individuals and immigrants, who were the primary audience for the first motion pictures. And when that happened, their first response was to launch a crusade against the movies and what they regard as the deleterious effects of the movies on that audience. And in fact, there was an anti-Semitic component ultimately in this crusade, because why, the question had to be asked, why would anyone, or who would undermine the prevailing social order? Who would subvert traditional American values? And of course, the answer was, well, immigrants, people who don't understand America. And it was a very short jump from accusing immigrants of subverting American values to accusing Jews, who at that time were exhibiting movies and ultimately would be producing and distributing movies.
But you point out that even the darkened theater was considered an environment that could breed iniquity.
You're right, Terry. In fact, we have to use our sympathetic imaginations to get back to the movie-going experience at the turn of the century and actually up through the teens. Today, the movie-going experience is something very different. But in those days, I mean, you go into a darkened theater. The audience was primarily women and children. You'd eat peanuts and fruit and whatever during the movie. It was a very democratic experience. You'd talk during the movie. Now, obviously, the movies were silent, although there was musical accompaniment. And afterwards, when you left the movie house, I describe a passage in the book from an editorial in The Nation, titled, the editorial was titled, A Democratic Art. And afterwards, as that editorial describes, you know, individuals would discuss the movies, talk about them with great seriousness. I mean, the movies very quickly became an important part of the cultural lives of immigrants and working class individuals in this country. In a way that obviously Thomas Edison, who took credit for inventing the movies, and other Gentiles in no way could have anticipated, but in a way that the Jews, who exhibited movies and would ultimately produce movies, did anticipate. And it was their real strength in, if you want to use the term, in conquering the movie industry.
How do you think the personality traits of the individual studio owners were reflected in the studios that they built and in the kind of movies that they made? Maybe you could give us a couple of examples.
Some of these things are very subtle, and some aren't. I mean, in the case of the Warner Brothers, I think it's not very subtle. Jack Warner, who was the head of production of the studio, essentially, was a kind of rapscallion. He disavowed anything Jewish, disavowed anything European. He regarded himself as an American, born and bred. And the movies reflected a kind of urbanized underclass quality that anyone who enjoys Warner Brothers pictures would recognize instantly. Even the stars at Warner Brothers reflected Jack Warner in a way. Humphrey Bogart and Cagney and Betty Davis. These weren't the aestheticized figures that you find in the movies of Paramount or of MGM. I mean, these were battlers. These were people on the margins. So I would say that, you know, Warner Brothers movies romanticized outsiders because the Warners themselves regarded themselves as outsiders, outside the Hollywood establishment, outside the American establishment. On the other hand, Paramount Pictures, and the studio, as we mentioned, was run by Adolf Zukor. He set the agenda for that studio, had a kind of continental sheen. The great stars of Paramount, you think of Maurice Chevalier and Cary Grant, who worked there frequently. There was something very sophisticated, very Tony, about the movies of Paramount, which reflected Adolf Zukor's aspirations. There's something very European about the films of Paramount. And many of the stars and many of the directors, Ernst Lubitsch being perhaps the primary example, were European. MGM, on the other hand, had a kind of schizophrenic quality. On the one hand, there was the glamorous Grand Hotel element of MGM, best typified, I think, by Greta Garbo. On the other hand, there was that domestic side of MGM, best exemplified by Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney in the Andy Hardy pictures. And those reflected two sides of Louis B. Mayer. On the one hand, Mayer with his aspirations to opulence and to grandeur. And on the other hand, the kind of puritanical little Louis Mayer who believes so fervently in moral values. And that's reflected, as I say, in the Andy Hardy pictures.
Columbia was sometimes called Poverty Row because they operated on such skimpy budgets and underpaid, or were reluctant to pay. I'm not sure which.
Both. Harry Cohn, who ran Columbia, yes, was very reluctant to pay decent salaries.
Oh, and I think one writer called it the equivalent of a police state. Describe a little bit what the atmosphere was like at Columbia in the early days and what, if anything, you think that had to say about Harry Cohn, who ran the studio.
Well, it had a lot to say about Harry Cohn. Harry Cohn, as I describe him in the book, waged a war against the world. Though he did have certain genteel aspirations, like Louis B. Mayer and Adolf Zukor and several of the others. On the other hand, Cohn saw himself as a kind of naked aggressor in a world of naked aggressors. The term I use in the book, I say, in a world of prostitutes, he wanted to be the procurer. And he ran the studio very much that way. There's a great story, and I heard this several times, about the way Harry Cohn operated. You'd come to him with a story idea or whatever, and Cohn would say no, without even listening. And if you took that no, you'd never get anything done at the studio. On the other hand, if after Cohn said no, you argued. You said, but Harry, I want to tell you something. This is why I think it'll work, and on and on and on. Cohn would almost always give in. I mean, Cohn operated the studio essentially as a test of one's mettle. And if you had that mettle, as Frank Capra, the most famous director at Columbia, did, you succeeded. And if you didn't, you could never succeed there. Cohn wanted a battle, and he believed that the best art came out of a kind of contentiousness, and he was certainly contentious. You used the term police state. I mean, he would watch his writers. The writers were arrayed around a kind of quadrangle at the old Columbia, and Cohn could look out his window into their offices and see who was typing and who wasn't, and he'd phone them if they weren't typing and say, "You're not typing." As if, you know, the job of a writer was to sit at a typewriter. Any contemplation was verboten. But that was the way that Harry Cohn operated. And, you know, though in the history of Hollywood, he's regarded as something like a, pariah, the most anti-art, you know, mogul of them all. On the other hand, you look at the pictures that Columbia produced, the great pictures of Frank Capra and some of the great comedies of George Stevens, and there are some really extraordinary films there. And I think it's because, though Cohn was a difficult man for whom to work, on the other hand, he was a very, very supportive employer if you believed in yourself. He believed in you.
It's great because you're describing this police state and Capra's making these populist movies.
That's right. And Capra didn't, the irony wasn't lost on Frank Capra either.
My guest is film critic Neil Gabler, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. And the book is a study of the first film moguls, the moguls who ran the early film studios, and most of these moguls were Jewish. So Gabler's book investigates what Judaism meant in their lives and how, if at all, it affected the movies they made and the studios they ran. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Neil Gabler is my guest, and you might remember him as a former co-host of the public television movie review show, Sneak Previews. I think a lot of us know by now that Paul Muni's real name was, what, Muni Wiesenfeld?
That's correct. Wiesenfreund.
Wiesenfreund. And a lot of the actors got very anglicized or Americanized names, actors who had very ethnic names, Polish, Italian, Jewish. Did the studio heads have anything to do with that decision?
Very much so. In regard to Jewish actors particularly, there was an incredible sensitivity. The idea was that Jews should be seen and not heard. And someone like Paul Muni is a perfect example. His life in some ways is a symbol of the way in which the Jewish actor was treated in Hollywood. He was always wrapped in someone else's ethnicity. He could never be a Jew or never play himself, in fact. And I have a story in the book from a close friend of Muni's that Muni would even answer the door in makeup because he had so far erased his own identity. And his tragedy is essentially, writ large, the tragedy of the other Jewish performers. Edward G. Robinson could play an Italian, but not a Jew. Ethnicity was something that was looked on askance by most of the Jewish moguls. After all, ethnicity was the very thing they were trying to escape. The very thing they were trying to establish is this idea that there is an America, this homogenized America with a set of traditional values. And although the Warner Brothers depart somewhat from that, they don't depart from the sense of America. Theirs is a slightly different version of America, but it's an America in which there is, you know, essentially a middle-class, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant population. And that ethnics, you know, shine shoes and perform and commit crimes as they do in the Warner Brothers movies, but they don't do a lot more than that.
Well, I wonder how much you think that is a result of the desire to assimilate on the part of the Jews who ran the industry, and how much of it was just good demographic sense, you know, that there weren't that many Jews in America compared to, say, other ethnic groups, and if they made movies about Jews, maybe they wouldn't sell as well at the box office.
I think, Terry, it's partly both. I think, you know, one, obviously they always had their eye on the box office. On the other hand, I think that the last thing they wanted to do is to create in the public consciousness a sense that Jews, foreigners, whatever, subversives, were running the industry. They lived in the constant fear, from the time that they took over the industry to the time they left it, they lived in the constant fear that somehow it would all be taken away from them. Because, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, very early on there was a campaign with an anti-Semitic tinge that somehow the movies were subverting American values because Jews were running them. And then into the 30s, there was a Legion of Decency, which essentially was promulgating the same idea that the movies were subverting American values and had to be cleaned up. And then, of course, you have HUAC and the Blacklist and all the things that happened in the 40s, which had, as I indicate in the book, the perspective I take on that situation in the book, is that there was very definitely an anti-Semitic quality to Representative Martin Dias and others who ran that committee, and that it wasn't simply a matter of cleaning up the movies, but at least as the film executives perceived it, it was also a matter of cleaning up the executives who ran the movies and putting real Americans in those positions. So I think the idea somehow that the men who ran the movies weren't real Americans was something that terrified the Hollywood moguls, the Jewish moguls. And they did their best to portray themselves as real Americans, full-fledged aristocratic Americans. And they created their own aristocracy out in California.
But you describe how when big finance moved in and invested in the film industry, that gradually fewer and fewer Jews were represented on the board of directors of the major studios.
That's true. I mean, Wall Street money moves into the motion picture industry fairly early, as soon as they realized that it wasn't a novelty, in fact, but that it was very central to the American cultural life. And as that happens, gradually, over the years, and accelerated during the Depression, when, contrary to popular belief, I mean, the motion pictures industry did not weather the Depression as well as, you know, one might think. Everyone thinks of, you know, Americans going to the movies throughout the Depression and laughing their cares away, and that really was not the way it happened. In fact, almost every major studio, with the exception of MGM, either was in receivership or was in very dire financial straits. So gradually, and accelerated by the Depression, Wall Street money and Wall Street, you know, individuals moved into the companies and onto the boards, and as that happened, the power of the Hollywood Jews diminished. Also, they got older, and the power diminished because of that. And other economic changes took place in the industry, television and its incursions. The Justice Department won a consent decree from the motion picture industry to divorce exhibition from distribution and production, and that changed the motion picture industry. And so all of these things ultimately contributed to breaking up what I regarded as kind of monarchies. I mean, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Columbia, Universal, all of these things were monarchies in which the Jewish moguls were the monarchs. And as all of these other forces came into play over the years, by the early 1950s, the monarchies were beginning to crumble.
How much do you think that the personal imprint of the monarchs still remains?
Not very much today. I think that the studio today obviously is a very different creature. The studio today is essentially a financing and distribution mechanism. The people who wield the real power in Hollywood are the stars and the directors, not the executives. And in fact, the one individual who did try to run a studio in recent Hollywood history, the way that a Louis B. Mayer ran MGM, was David Putnam at Columbia. I mean, Putnam really had a philosophy that Columbia's movies ought to have a special imprint, that they ought to have a special quality. And you saw what happened to David Putnam. I mean, he had a very, very brief run as a Columbia executive, largely because I think you can't run a studio that way any longer.
I want to quote something, or that is paraphrase something that Pauline Kael once wrote. She said that the balance between art and commerce is always a precarious one, but in the movie industry, at least movies were in the hands of businessmen who loved the movies, but now that conglomerates have taken over, that's no longer the case. I wonder if you'd agree with that and what you think that finally means in the way that movies have been affected.
I would certainly agree with the first part of it. I mean, the men I write about in my book loved movies passionately, every single one of them. I mean, to the point where I have that story between the confrontation between Frank Capra and Harry Cohn. And Harry Cohn, Capra's bringing a lawsuit against Cohn, and I won't go into the details. The important thing is the punchline. Cohn saying, getting on his hands and knees, essentially, in front of Capra and crying and saying, Columbia is my life. It may mean nothing to you, but it's everything to me. And I think that attitude actually characterized the attitude of almost all the individuals I write about. The movies were their lives. They loved movies passionately, and I think it's one of the reasons that they made the kinds of movies they did, movies that have endurance, movies that we look at today and enjoy. I'm not so sure about the second half of that equation. It's very easy to kind of throw brickbats at the executives in Hollywood today, and some of them certainly deserve it. But it's been my own personal experience that there are many executives in Hollywood who love movies almost as passionately as the men who ran the studios. I think the difference is that in those days, you had to love them that passionately. There was no other choice. You couldn't run a studio any other way. And today, there is a choice. I mean, you don't have to love the movies that way. You don't have to have any sense of movie history. You simply have to know how to make a deal. It's a matter of requirement rather than a matter of result, I think.
You make the case in your book that part of what drove the Jewish movie moguls into this Gentile vision of America was the desire to assimilate and to not be accused of being outsiders running the film industry. But on the other hand, everything was so airbrushed in the movies. I mean, everybody was perfected in a way so that nobody would really recognize themselves on screen. Do you know what I mean? Do you think that perhaps you've overemphasized of assimilation?
I don't think so, Terry, because what you're describing is something that was the consequence of the men who ran the studios. Remember that they take over the studios in the late teens, and they govern the motion picture industry, this small group of individuals, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s. So that what you're describing, this kind of sanitized version of American life, in which almost everyone is airbrushed, is a consequence of the Hollywood Jews' control of the industry.
Neil Gabler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Gabler has been my guest. He's a film critic who you might, by the way, remember from his three seasons as the co-host of Sneak Previews on public television. His new book is called An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. It's published by Crown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist Elaine Shannon. She's the author of the new book, Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and The War America Can't Win. Shannon has reported on the international drug trade for 10 years, and she's a Washington correspondent for Time magazine. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's more to conducting an orchestra than playing music. You have to navigate your way through the bureaucracy, union rules and regulations, and the business office. Coming up, Edo DeVart discusses the joys and frustrations of leading an orchestra. DeVart is the conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra and former conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the late Michael Bloomfield. Bloomfield's guitar style helped bring the blues from folk music into rock and roll. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bird, Clint Eastwood's movie about the life of jazz great Charlie Parker. Eastwood says it's the first jazz movie made by someone who actually likes the music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. One of the world's biggest private banks has been indicted in Florida and charged with laundering millions of dollars for Colombia's drug barons. U.S. officials say it's the first case of its kind involving a large international financial institution. More from Alan Tomlinson in Tampa.
The Bank of Credit and Commerce International is the seventh biggest private bank in the world. It got that way, according to the U.S. Justice Department, partly by laundering the profits of Colombia's cocaine barons. An American undercover agent infiltrated the money laundry and passed $32 million through the hands of BCCI officials in eight U.S. cities. Profits from cocaine sales on U.S. streets were allegedly deposited at the bank's U.S. branches, then disguised by overseas transactions so that legitimate-looking funds could be drawn by the drug cartels at other branches worldwide. After a two-year investigation, customs agents in the U.S., Britain, and France moved in during the past 3 days, making dozens of arrests. Nine of those charged are senior bank officials. U.S. Customs Commissioner William Von Raab described the roundup as his agency's first ever corporate raid. He said it had given new meaning to the term hostile takeover. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Tampa.
The government today said it has ordered for safety reasons the shutdown of a nuclear plant in Colorado. The Department of Energy said a minor safety incident over the weekend prompted the order to curtail all operations at the Rocky Flats nuclear plant, which produces weapons-grade plutonium. The department said it expects additional shutdowns at other aging nuclear facilities while it institutes strict new safety precautions. An Energy Department official said the new guidelines will also delay the startup of the Savannah River nuclear plant in South Carolina, which has been shut down since August because of safety concerns. The General Accounting Office charges and the Energy Department admits that security has been inadequate at some of the nation's most sensitive nuclear weapons research labs. Hundreds of foreign visitors have been allowed access to the labs without required background investigations. NPR's David Malpas reports.
According to a GAO report delivered to the Senate today, the visitors to the weapons labs included at least three suspected foreign agents and dozens of specialists believed to be working on nuclear weapons in their own countries. Many of the visitors who failed to receive background checks were from communist countries. The GAO's Keith Fultz said the Department of Energy is routinely failing to follow its own security procedures.
It is not adequately checking before, during, or after the foreign visits. We have little confidence that adequate protection of weapons-related information and technology is achieved by DOE.
Department of Energy officials conceded that the system had broken down, but they say tighter procedures are now in place. They stress that there's no evidence the foreigners obtained secret information during their visits. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
In Algeria today, President Chadli Benjadid announced that a state of emergency imposed last Thursday on riot-torn Algiers will be lifted tomorrow morning. Chadli ordered troops into the streets of Algiers to quell rioting by angry crowds protesting the nation's current economic crisis. Demonstrators stayed off the streets today, but young protesters who led the riots reportedly remain angry. Hospital officials say 250 people were killed in the riots, but Western diplomats say the death toll could be as high as 500. In a speech last night, the Algerian president promised political reforms and hinted he might not run for another term in office. Stock prices edged downward today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped almost 2.5 points to close at 2156.47. Declines led advances 7-5 on volume of 141 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 4 cents. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1982, rock historian Ed Ward completed a biography of the late rock guitarist Michael Bloomfield. Ed remembers Bloomfield not only as one of the nicest guys he's ever known, but as the man who brought the sound of the Chicago blues to rock and roll.
Guitar heroes are a dime a dozen these days, to the point where mere technique and speed have almost totally eclipsed feeling. It wasn't always that way. In fact, virtuoso rock and roll electric guitar didn't exist in this country before Michael Bloomfield. Bloomfield was born into a rich Jewish family in Chicago whose fortune had been made in restaurant equipment. From the start, Michael was a rebel, though, with no intention of going into the family business. He started playing rock and roll as a teenager and quickly discovered the folk scene at the University of Chicago. He seemed to have a natural inborn talent for guitar, and when he discovered the blues all around him in Chicago, that talent had found its outlet. He worked as the manager of a club for a while, presenting shows by older blues men who had been living in semi-retirement, but his real love was the music being made by Muddy Waters, Junior Wells, and Otis Rush on the South Side. Going to those clubs, he met some other white kids, and before he knew it, he was in a band. Paul Butterfield Blues Band was a truly radical act. Not only was it Chicago's first integrated blues band, but it was the first band to dare to suggest that electric, hard-driving blues was folk music, that blues wasn't something played by old black men whose best days were behind them. Signed by Elektra, one of the nation's leading folk labels, in 1965, they stirred up a storm of controversy almost immediately.
I was born in Chicago in 1941. Well, my father told me, son, you had better get a gun.
Tough, urban, with the sort of tinge of violence a song like Nick Gravanites' Born in Chicago carried with it, they weren't like anything on the folk or rock and roll scene. But the biggest controversy was yet to come. They played the 1965 Newport Folk Festival, first by themselves, and then backing Bob Dylan in his famous Newport Electric debut. Dylan then borrowed Michael from the Butterfield Band and took him to New York to record his next album.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, do the bumps of time in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all.
Michael didn't really understand what Dylan was doing, and when he was invited to join the band Dylan was going to tour with, he decided to go back to Chicago. Reunited with Butterfield, he managed to take things a step further than they'd ever gone before. West was the most audacious record of 1966, a record that took rock and roll instrumentation and had it playing long, intelligent, jazz-like improvisations. It was incredible. It was also Michael's last album with the band. He hated touring, and he had another idea for an all-American music band with a horn section and the best musicians he could get. By now, everybody wanted to play with him, and so the Electric Flag was born.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of tomorrow. I urge every member of both parties.
They debuted at the Monterey Pop Festival and released their album soon afterwards, but Michael wouldn't tour and the band was thick with heroin. Soon, Michael was taking heroin himself, and that was the end of the band. Oh, there was the awful Super Session record with Al Kooper, and there were various projects throughout the 70s, but for the most part, Michael spent the decade at home in California playing guitar with whoever would drop by and reading compulsively. He'd quit heroin and start drinking, then fall back again. But by 1981, he was cured, back playing, trying to build things back up. Who knows what happened? On February 15, 1981, his body was found in a parked car in San Francisco. The coroner found death by cocaine and amphetamine poisoning, two drugs he was never known to take. All I know is a lot of us still miss him.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. That's the beginning of The Chairman Dances by John Adams, as recorded by the San Francisco Symphony, conducted by Ato DeVart. The Dutch-born conductor earned a reputation as a 20th-century music specialist when he was conductor of the San Francisco Symphony from 1977 to 1985. Currently, DeVart is music director of the Minnesota Orchestra and divides his time between Minneapolis and Amsterdam, where he's artistic director of the Dutch Radio Orchestra. As a music student in Amsterdam, DeVart studied oboe, but found his personality more suited for conducting.
I have always liked the total involvement. There must be a bossy side to me that it is nicer to tell people what to do than being told what to do. I'm sure that has something to do with it. I was always giving my opinions about everything, asked or unasked. And I think as a conductor, you have to have some of that. Although in personal life, that can be a real drag for the people around you. You just need to be able to have strong opinions and being willing to stand for them and get them knocked and still fight for them, which was one of the reasons why my conducting teacher took me. He said, yeah, it will be good for your character. You will finally understand how hard it is to conduct, since you have always so much criticism.
Was there one experience that really showed you how hard it was going to be?
I think once I started getting mixed reviews, you know, you go do a concert 1 week and they would say that is terrific, and the next week they would say this was no good at all. That was hard to take, to the public bashing that you get, and that took me many years to even get used to, and maybe one never gets totally used to being judged in public all the time, especially by people that you not always have a lot of respect for.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal, one has to learn in life, if you're not gifted with a great deal of personal charm and you know, I've always been a very direct person who said what he felt, and that coming from a 25-year-old whippersnapper to older musicians is not going to make life easy for you. And
yeah.
I must say, I ran into quite a lot of bad stuff in the beginning. You know, misunderstandings, things that I said and I didn't mean to say. So I had to, several times in Rotterdam, my first orchestra, which I went to when I was, how old was I, 26 or so, there have been 4 or 5 occasions where I apologized to the orchestra, not pressed by them, thank God, out of my own feeling that I had gone too far.
After establishing yourself in the Netherlands, you came fairly regularly to America to conduct. In 1975, you became principal guest conductor of the San Francisco Orchestra. Then you took over the orchestra in 1977. And I'm wondering what it was like to adjust to conducting in America. Did you find that the conductor was expected to have a different relationship to the players than what you were used to in the Netherlands?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because it has a lot to do with the way American orchestras are run, which to this day I have sometimes a hard time dealing with. And what I mean is that I come really out of a culture where the orchestra itself is very strong, sometimes runs itself basically, or at least is very heavily heard in every big decision. They have representation on the board. The board is only 5 to 7 or maybe 9 people at the most, not these 60, 70, 80 people boards that you have in America, and where the orchestra and management are actually seen as two totally contrary bodies that fire salvos over the continental divide. You know, it's just, it was different. And I must say, even though I've learned to deal with it, it is not natural for me to be that far removed in many ways from what actually make all of us be there, and that is the orchestra.
I think there's a lot of competition between orchestras in the United States. You know, who's going to get the big recording contract? Who's going to get the PBS series or the NPR series? Was there the same kind of competition in the Netherlands, or do you think that the States is more competitive between orchestras?
Oh, I think it is more competitive because the stakes are bigger. When you're all subsidized, you don't get this cutting edge of trying to sneak things away from under each other's noses. While here, where you really have to rely on selling tickets, this whole image thing, how are we perceived? How good are we? Are we perceived as being as good as we really are? And is our marketing doing well? You have to be much sharper. And you know, it brings non-artistic things to bear. I think a big danger threatening the whole American art scene, but particularly symphony orchestras, is that marketing departments, if we don't watch out, will dictate what we will play, and the programming will be dictated by how many people will we get into the hall, which will be tremendously impoverishing, because we know that if you play Beethoven 5 and 1812 and all that sort of stuff, you will have full halls, and if you play Sessions and Carter and other people, you will have 500-600 people there. And the more people you get, the more you will get unsophisticated people that had not normally thought of coming into the concert hall. And so in some ways we get them in. They are not the people that will take kindly to even Bartok and Stravinsky, let alone Schoenberg and Webern. And so in order to get them in, you will also have to do away with your adventurous programming.
I think audiences bring a lot of preconceptions and expectations to orchestral performances. Are there changes that you could make, if you could basically redesign our conception of an orchestra from scratch?
I think we have become too much institutionalized. We have become too little adventurous, and we have become too much set in ways that maybe are not all that good for the music. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? Why are we playing Beethoven? What did it mean at that time when Beethoven's Fifth first rolled through that hall? People must have jolted in their seats. We don't have that surprise anymore. So we must, in the way we play it, we must try and think back how it was. This might mean that we behave ourselves a little different, that it is, maybe it wasn't so bad that Toscanini sometimes yelled. Maybe we only have to get used to that orchestra musicians will yell back, and that necessarily is not all that bad.
For years, you were thought of as one of the new, young, rising conductors to watch out for. And now you're approaching middle age. And I was wondering if you approach your scores differently than you did when you were younger.
Yeah, I think I have seen myself gone through two phases very much. At the very beginning, this wonderment and this wonderful adventure trip through a country and through places that I'd never seen before, that I just knew existed. However, I did them with a breakneck speed and very seldom got a chance to really look at the pieces because I did so many of them. It's like some American tourist doing Europe in 6 days and saying, oh, I've seen Florence and Rome and all these cities. And, well, they saw the airports. And I think I sometimes felt that I only saw the airports. And then there came a phase where I was got the responsibility for first the Rotterdam Philharmonic and then San Francisco, and felt I've always been someone who is very interested in the intricacies of playing, of the fundamentals of music making, not just seeing making music as a state of mind, but as a craft. And I became very much obsessed with that, and the music suffered in many ways. I think these last couple of years, more and more, there is happening some sort of an amalgamation of everything. Everything is... I am now in the happy circumstance that I am music director of a very good orchestra, which can play terrific technically and musically, and I also seem to be more able to both in rehearsal work on the technical side and the musical side. And in many ways, this is almost the most exciting time that I've had as a music director, and I hope it will last.
Ada DeVort is music director of the Minnesota Orchestra, and here they are performing music by Strauss. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead to All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we have a report today on a press conference that the Energy Department held to say that it is aggressively working to solve problems in nuclear facilities around the country. This in the wake of revelations that Energy Department officials have been keeping accidents at federal nuclear facilities secret for years, and that safety problems have forced the government to shut down nuclear facilities just in recent weeks. Also, about 1,500 angry AIDS activists blocked the Food and Drug Administration building today to protest the U.S. government's response to the AIDS epidemic. Among other things, the demonstrators were demanding accelerated trials of AIDS treatment drugs and comprehensive health care for participants involved in such trials.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. By the time of his death at 34, saxophonist Charlie Parker had forever changed jazz. Now his life is the basis of the new film Bird, directed by Clint Eastwood. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
You don't really expect the most uncompromising Hollywood movie ever made about jazz to come from Clint Eastwood, any more than you'd expect Jerry Lewis to come up with the definitive biography of Camus. But at nearly 3 hours, Bird is not only uncompromising, it may strike some people as downright unbearable. In recounting the life of Charlie Parker, the jazz saxophonist who may have been the greatest American musician of the century, Eastwood makes no concessions to the mass audience he knows so well. Instead of souping up the storytelling and tantalizing us toward the edge of our seat, Eastwood goes for an impressionistic collage of incidents and images. There are flashbacks within flashbacks, and the movie has almost no narrative momentum. But for those who are passionate about jazz, Bird conjures up the bebop world of the 40s and 50s with extraordinary intelligence and taste. Parker was the sort of doomed genius that Hollywood has always adored. He was alcoholic and addicted to heroin, and in the years before his death, at the age of 34, he became increasingly unreliable. So perhaps the most surprising thing about Eastwood's film is its refusal to preach at us on the evils of a dissolute lifestyle. In fact, this scene is about as close to preachy as the movie gets. It takes place on a California beach, where we find level-headed Dizzy Gillespie, played by Samuel E. Wright, talking sense to Charlie Parker, played by Forrest Whitaker.
They're gonna talk about you when you're dead, Bert. what they do now, they're gonna shovel you under like they love to do, and they're gonna talk about you. My secret is, if they kill me, it won't be because I helped them.
Whitaker is a little young for the role, but what he lacks in authority and seasoned presence, he makes up for with the peculiar jazzy spin he puts on his line readings. Through the prism of his acting, you can see all the refractions of Bird's complex personality, the self-hatred, the overweening pride, the black intellectual flaunting his education, and the haunted little boy who can't seem to be good. Even better is Diane Venora as Parker's white wife, Chan. Her performance is fierce and cool and earthy, and we gradually come to see Parker the way her Chan sees him, as a genius who comes with demons attached, an addict for whom heroin is not a vice, but some kind of terrible lifeblood. One can complain about the movie's shapelessness, and I certainly wish Eastwood would give up his passion for interior lighting so dark that you might as well be watching Balinese shadow puppets. But Eastwood has never shown so much interest in cinematic sensuousness, in camera movement and atmosphere, and there can be no complaint about the music. Eastwood has excised Parker's solos from old recordings and recorded new backup music beneath them, and the effect is wonderful, state-of-the-art bebop. Bird is far from perfect, but we can be grateful that Eastwood was the one to finally tell this story. Almost no one else in Hollywood would have had the clout to bring it off with such honesty, with so little schmaltz and message-mongering, and with so much fidelity to the music itself.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with science writer Dougal Dixon. His new book, The New Dinosaurs, mixes fantasy and science to answer the question, if dinosaurs hadn't become extinct, what would they look like today? Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new recording featuring Dubravka Tomsic, a little-known Yugoslavian pianist who Lloyd thinks will be a lot better known a year from now. And on the 25th anniversary of the book Up the Down Staircase, guest critic Maureen Corrigan examines how well the novel's portrayal of teachers holds up. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of Philadelphia's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.